In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 386. We're talking about fascism today because this is a concept and a word that gets thrown around all the time. Well, this person is a fascist. Well, why? What makes that person a fascist? Well, I don't like him, is really what it boils down to. Well, it turns out that there really is a definition of fascism. It really was a thing. It's not just whatever we happen to dislike. And you see this done all over the place. It's mostly done by the left, but I see neoconservatives, I see libertarians carelessly tossing around the word fascist as a synonym for something I dislike. And that doesn't help clarify anything, and it's annoying. So it's important to go back into history and look at what we're talking about here. What fascism really means. What is it? Because it's useful to know what fascism is. It's an important moment in European history. And so we're going to focus on that today. We're going to talk to Paul Gottfried, who has an article in the American Conservative magazine, Who Isn't Fascist?, that goes through this phenomenon whereby everything is referred to as fascism these days. This is not helpful if intellectual clarity is your goal. Paul Gottfried joins us once again. He appeared to talk about World War I in the past. We'll link to that on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/386. But Paul is Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Elizabethtown College and a Guggenheim recipient. He is the author of numerous books, including After Liberalism, Mass Democracy in the Managerial State, Conservatism in America, Making Sense of the American Right, The Strange Death of Marxism, The European Left in the New Millennium, Leo Strauss and the Conservative Movement in America, and Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt Toward a Secular Theocracy. We will be linking to those books as well on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/386. So here's my conversation with Paul Gottfried. I hope you enjoy it. Paul Gottfried, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
I love talking about this subject because, as you say, the term fascist or the term fascism, these words are thrown around as just catch-all epithets, and they, unfortunately, they do stick, even though the accusations behind them are completely empty. People think that fascist is a word that nobody likes, so I'll use that to describe my enemies. And this is not just something that the left does, although the left is, they're experts at it. The so-called right, the neocons, use fascist too, but in the same way that they try to use the word bigotry, and it totally fails when the left uses bigotry against anybody who just has traditional views. The right tries to shoot back, well, you're anti-Christian, so you're a bigot. That never sticks. Nobody cares. Culture doesn't move in that direction. I think to understand this better, why don't we start off by talking about what fascism really is. It actually does have a meaning, and then we can see how preposterous it is to throw it around so casually.
Yeah, I think in the book that I did and in a number of essays I've written on fascism, I indicate that it is very much of an interwar European movement. I also distinguish what I call generic fascism, which is sort of quintessential or essential fascism, from Nazism and from those collaborationist governments that Hitler used in running countries that he occupied. Marechal Pétain in France or Salaschi in Hungary, some of these other people who collaborated with it were not really fascists. They were just nasty anti-Semites or, in the case of Pétain, somebody who was old and senile and decided he couldn't fight anymore and collaborated. The generic, what I call generic fascists, seem to do best in Latin Catholic countries. They are not usually devout Catholics, except for the clerical fascists, who are not really fascists, but they take over certain Catholic social theories and organizational forms. Corporatism as a kind of variant on medieval economic theory, for instance, is something which they like. They're also very critical of the Protestant world, which they associate with individualism. And if one is really looking for a kind of template for them, the one that fits most accurately, I think, it may be a kind of glorified Roman imperial template. I mean, they're sort of like looking back at the Roman Empire, one might say through colored lenses. And the regime that, in fact, the only fascist regime one can turn to as a quasi-successful one is the government of Italy under Mussolini that is established in the early 1920s. And there you sort of see fascism at work. It is not a terribly sinister or murderous movement. It is also not an economically efficient one. It is authoritarian, but not totalitarian. And one of the arguments I make in my book is if the Nazis had not come along and co-opted some of the symbolism of the movement, and if Mussolini had not fallen into the Nazi camp stupidly, which he did, probably fascism would be remembered simply as a kind of historical curiosity. One of the main reasons, of course, it becomes so sinister is that it is associated with Nazism, which I think is a very aberrant and eclectic form of fascism that is at least as much influenced by Stalinism as it is by Italian fascism. The other reason is that the communists and the left generally see fascism as the enemy, not only fascism as it existed in the 1920s or 1930s, but fascism as it has been reconfigured or reinvented by the left in every generation.
What kind of features would we look for in a regime to identify it as fascist? I think we can get a sense of, in other words, economically, what would we look for? Politically, what would we look for? How would we know this is a fascist regime and this isn't?
Okay, first of all, I would say it does have a temporal and spatial context. That is to say, not every government that is authoritarian is a fascist government. There is a very good historian of fascism named Gregor, A. James Gregor, who has published works in which he's argued that developmental dictatorships in Africa and Asia are simply continuations of the kind of government that Mussolini creates in Italy in the 1920s. I think that this is vastly overstated. Fascism develops as a reaction to the revolutionary left of the 1920s, typically sort of in less developed countries that are on the way to modernization, and perhaps most typically in Latin countries. I'm not quite sure what I would look for today, because I think fascism is an anachronism.
But when I say when we look back to the third, how do we know that Italy was fascist other than they said that it was? What
features
of the regime?
They not only said they were fascist, they created a model of fascism.
I'm driving at. What's the model?
Well, I mean, the model is one as a corporate state, or one that is formally organized as a corporate state, because it never really means very much. That is to say, there is no nationalization of the means of production that takes place in fascist Italy. In fact, there's free enterprise, but there's some kind of corporate scheme which they try to apply to the economics and the vocational councils that are overseen by a central state and by the leader of the central state. Another thing is the imitation of Roman forms, which the Italian fascists are very good at. I mean, they revive Roman symbols, Roman titles. So there is very much of a Latin-Roman quality to fascism. Another thing is some kind of theory of integral nationalism, that the nation is seen as a kind of sacred entity that has an organic life of its own. And what they clearly reject is both liberalism in the classical sense, in which we would probably, you know, both you and I would think it's a good thing, that they do reject liberalism. theoretically, they reject a free market economy, though there's very little they do actually to restrict the economy, except in theory. And they also, of course, hate the revolutionary left because it is internationalist and egalitarian. And like most movements of the right, the fascists stress hierarchy. Of course, it's a largely invented hierarchy that they give us because the traditional social order has, you know, collapsed or is disintegrating by then. You have no aristocracy is not important, but what they have is their own fascist social order that they create, which is an attempt to sort of imitate Roman militarism. You always get this archaic Roman quality in all fascist movements. And they're always sort of harking back to the ancient Romans. The other thing that's interesting is there is an attempt to create a fascist internationalism in the 1930s, and there are lots of movements which see Mussolini as a model leader, including right-wing Zionists, the Back to Africa Black movement. There are many such movements you can point to in which Italian fascism is seen as a model by revolutionary nationalists outside of Italy. The right-wing Zionists, in fact, trained their troops in fascist Italy. And up until his alliance with Hitler, Mussolini is very, very pro-Zionist and is very sympathetic to the movement to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. He also expresses sympathy for blacks, you know, and for victims of Anglo-French colonialism. So he is looked to by black leaders like Marcus Garvey, you know, as a figure to be emulated by black nationalists. So that fascism, you know, is sort of rooted in its time, but you know, it also has a kind of international resonance. I mean, it is on the other hand, because it is so nationalist, it is very hard for fascism, like communism or like liberalism, to become an international movement.
Right, and I read your. I want to make sure people know that we're talking primarily about an article you wrote for The American Conservative magazine.
Right, right.
Who isn't fascist? I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/386. But we're also, at least obliquely, talking about a book you have coming out in the not too distant future. Tell us the title, because I love the title.
Well, the book is called Fascism: The Career of a Concept, and the book, which Northern Illinois University Press is bringing out this summer. Deals not only with fascists, but also with the wide range of anti-fascists who have developed, you know, supposedly an opposition to whatever they define as fascism from the 1930s on. And, of course, I make the argument that most anti-fascists since the Second World War are not reacting to any kind of real fascist presence, but simply reacting to whatever they consider reactionary or right-wing. Which is then defined as fascist, and is then sort of linked somewhat circuitously to Nazism and to the Holocaust. This is typical of the way the left sort of operates to demonize its opposition. And most of my book, in fact, is devoted to explaining what fascism is not, and to the demonization of everything which is distasteful to the left, whatever the left is, you know, and that left will then define fascism as the absolute enemy.
Let's be equal opportunity critics here and say a little something about Jonah Goldberg, who had a very good selling book, I'm sorry to say, called Liberal Fascism, I think it was called.
Yes, and the book was on the bestseller list for 12 weeks. It went from February through April 2008. It was in the first week of March, it became the bestseller in the United States. It's called Liberal Fascism. It is an absolutely horrible book.
Yeah. Now, I bring it up because I believe it was successful for largely the same reasons that Colin Powell might have been thought of as a good presidential candidate. He would be nothing would change under a president Colin Powell, but conservatives want to be able to say, I'm not a racist. And likewise, they want to take that fascist label, turn it around, and point it at their enemies and say, aha, the real fascist is Hillary Clinton. What's the problem with that?
Yeah, that's exact. That's exactly what the book does. What you find throughout the book is there are the juxtaposing of things that are unlike that are made to seem similar, and there also is a confounding of Italian fascism with, you know, Nazism and anything else which is going to scare the reader. The thing that I find most interesting about the book is that Goldberg condemns Democratic presidents for doing things that are much less statist than things that he himself favors in a Republican president. I'm no great fan of Woodrow Wilson, either domestically or in his international politics, but the government that he left us with was much smaller than the government of George W. Bush, which Goldberg approves of. Goldberg actually went after Rand Paul for suggesting that we might want to get rid of the Department of Education. He thought that this was an extreme position. Now, this is the same Goldberg who's condemning Woodrow Wilson and other Democrats for favoring a much smaller welfare state than we have right now. So it's the partisan hypocrisy of the book that I found even more offensive than the stupid things that Goldberg says about the fascist movement.
You know, in reading your article, I came up with a question that may be a selfish one because maybe I'm the only one who wants it answered. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna hold that off for a minute. But you did say at the end of the article that fascism you do identify as a right-wing movement, at least
yes,
in part because it emerges in response to, mm-hmm. as you said earlier, the revolutionary left. It
right.
also so there's a context for where fascism comes from. It doesn't just develop out of nowhere. It also, it seems to me, comes out of the spirit of World War I. If you have somebody like Mussolini, who had been a socialist but couldn't accept the pure internationalist anti-war position of socialism,
right.
gets a whiff of nationalism and can't let go of it, you then take that in the post-war world and you take the American progressive line that if we planned in war, we can plan in peace, and you build a philosophy around it, that during the war, we didn't have all this regionalist bickering. We were all Italians, and there is something tremendously moving about the fact that we came together in a common corporate enterprise that was not individualist in any way. We planned the economy, so we are not interested in classical liberalism in terms of economic arrangements. If we did that during war, can't we take this nationalist energy and plow it into our peacetime projects? There's something to that too, right?
There certainly is. that's correct. And the there's not only the wartime thinking. You know, the Germans have the expression "die Mobilmachung," the mobilization of war. This almost comes almost a kind of mystique of mobilization after the war. But there also, in the case of Italy and other countries, is bitterness about not receiving for the sacrifices they had made in war all of the territories they were promised. Of course, the Italians probably got much more than they deserved, and they sort of entered the war, by betraying their other allies. The same thing which the Romanians did. But then they felt that the Allies, with whom they put themselves on the same side, did not give them enough after the war. So it is this resentment about the peace that will also fan the flames of fascism. But you're absolutely right. And, I think there are aspects of the progressive movement that do look very much like fascism. I think the progressive movement is sort of strange. I would have to argue that although it is mostly a movement of the left, you do get rightist elements in the progressive movement as well. I didn't want to emphasize this in some of the critiques of Goldberg that I wrote, but I think in the case of the progressives, and you do get ideas about eugenics, racial hygiene. You don't really get this in Mussolini. You certainly do get this in other movements of the nationalist right in interwar Europe. And the progressives do use nationalist themes, even in the United States. So I think there is at least some kind of conceptual bridge that I can see between the fascists. There also are left-wing fascists, whom I don't discuss in my article, and while they are nationalists, some of these people like Giuseppe Bottai in Italy are thoroughgoing socialists. I mean, they you know, they want it entirely socialized, but they do hate the left. They hate the communists, even the left-wing fascists, and they do have some theory of integral nationalism that comes out of this. And as you said, you're quite right. They all look back to the war experience as, you know, a unifying experience from which you know, fascist theory and fascist sentiments can be derived.
All right, here's the question that maybe I'm the only one who wants the answer to, but of course, I mean, I wouldn't even insult you by asking if you're, of course, you know the work of Erich von Kuhnelt-Leddihn.
Yes.
And he has a book, Leftism, and mm-hmm. I think deliberately to get under the skin of leftists, in his subtitle, he lists several people he considers leftists to indicate that he's going to talk about a wide range of leftists.
And he puts
Hitler in that list. Now, that is obviously meant to be provocative. Do you think there is any merit in his claim that Hitler belongs on the left, given that you say that fascism obviously is a movement of the right?
Yeah. Now, I would say that, Nazism is different from generic fascism in that it does borrow more heavily from leftist totalitarianism. And I agree entirely with Ernst Nolte that Stalin, and also with Hannah Arendt, that Stalin is a kind of model for Hitler. Even though he hates the communist and looks upon the Russians as Untermensch or something like that, but the collectivist economy, the use of terror to destroy his enemy, the demonization of entire groups that are marked out for destruction, and so this all looks very much like leftist totalitarianism. So I think that Nazism was parasitic on leftist totalitarianism in a way that generic fascism was not. But sort of getting back to this whole question of Kuhnelt-Leddihn, it is one that troubles me profoundly because I love the man. I mean, I was a great admirer and friend of Kuhnelt-Leddihn, and I agreed with just about everything he said, except when he claimed that, you know, that fascists were on the left. I disagreed with that position. On the other hand, I understood where he was coming from. He was a traditional European Hotspur conservative. And from their perspective, the fascists were on the left. Because, you know, the right were monarchist, and the right were legitimatist. They were people who favored a traditional social religious order. And the fascists did not favor that. They were the revolutionary right. So I understand that from his perspective, and also the perspective of somebody like George Kennan, who probably may be the closest to a traditional conservative, you know, that the United States produced in the 20th century. But he also looked upon the fascists as a movement of the left, although he had a certain sympathy for Salazar and even Franco. But he thought that the fascists were left-wing adventurers. So I can understand where Kuhnelt-Leddihn is coming from and how he arrives at that view. But I agree with you. I think he's trying to be provocative. I think he's also, you know, writing as a man of the traditional right, which gives him a very different perspective from that of most historians, or I would even say a different perspective from the one with which I'm approaching my subject.
Let me ask you a specific question that involves a specific type of criticism in which people would use fascist. People would say that if you are in favor of the traditional family, even if you don't favor the use of violence in any way to uphold this ideal, nevertheless, this is somehow a fascist sentiment. And if you press them on it, they'll say, well, Hitler was always appealing to the vigorous and robust German family, and so that makes it fascist. What do you say to that?
Well, the answer is that everybody until recently appealed to traditional, robust family.
My thought exactly.
Communists did, Stalin did, probably Castro. I mean, everyone did. That until the homosexual and feminist movements came along, most people thought, we have to remember the Communist Party violently attacked homosexuality as bourgeois decadence. so that the cultural Marxist revolution that we're seeing is a very recent thing. I always like to joke, it's not really a joke, it's probably true, that I consider Lenin to have been more conservative than Richard Lowry of the
National Review.
Because, you know, Lenin expressed very negative views about gays, unlike Goldberg and Lowry and these other neocon accessories.
I mean, Paul, I remember being in an event conference with Eugene Genovese, who obviously had a lot of experience with Marxists and communists. He knew them all.
Yeah.
He had fraternized with them. And there were a lot of young people in that audience who thought that communism and Marxism were going to be great vehicles for promoting, for example, homosexuality. And Genovese had to get up and shake his head and say, "Do you people know no institutional history whatsoever? you would not have been welcomed with open arms into the American Communist Party."
No, I remember the late Will Herberg told me that there was some person who came. He was malodorous and didn't dress well. And he was a communist at the time, said, "I bet this person is also a homosexual," which was probably the worst insult that a communist could give. Nonetheless, I find it remarkable that most of the left today continue to apologize for the communist. Who, you know, we would say probably had sound bourgeois views about many things. But, I mean, they I think by now it's a kind of almost reflex, a kind of involuntary reflex. You just, you know, the communists weren't bad. Or I have a student who's helping me with some editing who was telling me yesterday that that ISIS cannot be Muslim because Islam is a religion of peace. And the ISIS is really fascist, and the father of ISIS is Francisco Franco. Now, I'm trying to figure out where he got all that nonsense from, but obviously there's a lot of different narratives that are sort of mixed together there, a lot of leftist narratives. But, you know, you'd be surprised how often the memories of the 1930s come back, leftist memories or leftist myths of the 1930s. And sometimes, you know, these sort of get superimposed on cultural Marxism or get mixed in with this. So we assume that Stalin was in favor, or Mao or someone was in favor of gay marriage or feminism. Of course, they weren't. It's like all these various lefts become intermixed in the minds of young people who go through our educational system.
And, of course, one of the conclusions they reach in that system, and as you point out in your article, is the idea that all political evil comes from the right. So anything you don't even have to investigate it. You assume it came from the right, and that the left was always the revolutionary vanguard pushing for liberation. And that's certainly not the case in here. Let me shift gears before I let you go. I want to ask about the American neoconservatives. I could imagine some critics of the American neocons saying these people are pushing a really vulgar American nationalism, where, for example, just this morning I was leaving. I had to leave one of my children off at school, and one of the other parents was walking in with a shirt that said "Unapologetically American," and I thought, just low IQ American nationalism. They're encouraging this because it feeds into the war machine, it feeds into their plans, but yet that doesn't make them fascists just because they are encouraging American nationalism. Because for one thing, American nationalism is not German nationalism or Italian nationalism the way the German and Italian fascists conceived of their nationalisms.
That's right. I do agree. I mean, what they do is they define nationalism in such a way that it's essentially leftist. It is based on a universal propositional kind of identity and the notion that all people are created equal and we're all part of some community held together by human rights. I mean, there is almost a kind of revival of Jacobinism that I see in the neoconservatives. They're very different from the Italian fascists in that regard, or any of the fascist movements. Which stress integral identity, traditional social relations, the extent that those relations were, you know, still exist. But the fascists tend to have very traditional bourgeois views. But if you notice, the neoconservatives seem to have given up whatever was considered social traditionalism, you know, in the older generation of neoconservatives. I mean, they're now for gay marriage. There's this guy, Jamie Kirchick, who gave a speech at some neoconservative conference that I looked at, saying that Putin is a bad person, we should oppose him because he's against gay rights. Kirchhoff is one of the people they used to attack Ron Paul, I think, as a homophobe. But this is becoming the neoconservative view. This is also the view of Goldberg, John Podoretz. They've given up everything but the nationalism of war. I mean, that seems to be the only thing left. That in Zionism. If there's anything else that, you know, distinguishes them from Hillary or from the official left, I don't know what it is. So I think they very definitely have thrown away all the accessories, the moral cultural accessories, you know, that were part of their package at one time, and they simply, you know, favor sort of a kind of bogus nationhood, you know, that would lead to a policy of war.
Well, Paul, as I say, I'm going to link to your article, Who Isn't Fascist, from the American Conservative. I'll link to your website, which is paulgottfried.net, where people can read about your books and your current writings. And, of course, I want to talk about your book on fascism when it becomes available. This will all be linked at tomwoods.com/386. I appreciate your time today. I love talking to you because I know there is no question I could throw at you that's going to make things awkward and uncomfortable because you don't know the answer. You know, I never have to worry about that with you. Thanks so much, Paul. It was great.
And thank you for having me on.
All right, everybody, before I get into what we're going to talk about tomorrow, I want to just thank you guys for spreading the word about the show, for subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. Over at tomwoods.com, I'm releasing a new episode every weekday covering some topic related to liberty, and the show continues to grow. More downloads every month, the traffic increases every month, and that's thanks to you good folks spreading the word about it, and I'm very grateful to you for that. Tomorrow we're going to talk about a truly foundational topic. We're going to talk about rights and what they are and how we can derive them. And incidentally, we'll also cover whether animals might have them. And to talk to us about this, we'll be joined once again by our old friend Gary Chartier. So make sure not to miss that. And the best way not to miss it is to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so that you get the shows downloaded automatically. What a luxury. What a world we live in these days. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.